Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. You're watching Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Historically, healthcare issues have rarely, if ever, been the focus of any election campaign or manifesto. But given that the access to quality and affordable healthcare is a vital and basic right for everyone living in Malaysia, why shouldn't it be a crucial policy issue that must be addressed in these elections? Having said that, what are the key health issues and policies that all political parties need to address? I mean, not only in their GE campaigning, but also, if elected, must commit to fulfilling. Joining me on the show tonight to discuss this further, I have Dr. Koh Swee King. He's the co-founder of the Malaysian Health Coalition. Swee King, thank you for joining me on the show tonight. What do you think? Let's start our conversation with what you think. What health policies must be, should be in all political parties' election manifesto? Let's go through some key areas.
Melissa, it's great to be back. And perhaps there are three key areas for us to get started with considering. Let me list them. Human capital, health financing, and organization of service delivery. Let's go through them one by one. Human capital would be a long-term solution to the problems that are faced by contract doctors, contract pharmacists, contract dentists, contract nurses, and all the contract workers in the Ministry of Health. They should be given more permanent posts or at least longer-term contracts to allow them to plan their lives and to be able to better serve the community. And that's just one rabbit hole of the entire deep sector called human capital for health. That should be on the election manifesto. Long-term solutions to the human capital problems in Malaysia to ensure that we retain the best and brightest in our Ministry of Health and we don't lose them to the private sector. And we also certainly don't lose them to other countries. The second sector that should be really a part of the election manifestos of all political parties would be healthcare financing. Healthcare financing has traditionally been the government's responsibility. We may now need to move on to something that we're calling the shared responsibility for health. This means that although the government should really be the primary payer, as it should be, we should also share the responsibility to finance healthcare with employers for their, employees, insurance companies for their policyholders, community organizations and foundations for those who they donate to, and even individuals for themselves and their families. Only to shared responsibility for health, which is a principle that almost every developed country adheres to, can we then ensure sustainable long-term healthcare financing for Malaysia? And this requires very difficult political decisions to be made. That's the second sector. The third and final sector, Melissa, is something that we're calling the organization of service delivery. In practical terms, what this means is how much of healthcare should be delivered by the public sector versus the private sector in one health system. And it should be integrated instead of operating in the silo of the public sector and the private sector as well. The organization of service delivery also talks about primary, secondary, and tertiary care. When you think of tertiary care, you think of hospitals like General Hospital Kuala Lumpur or University of Malaya Medical Center or the state capital hospitals. But when you think of primary care, you should be thinking of clinics. But below primary care, there's even care at the community level and care even at home. And that's the organization of service delivery. And that should be part of the manifesto for political parties as well. There you have it, Melissa. The first three, human capital, health financing, and thirdly, the organization of service delivery.
That's a lot to go on for the next half an hour. I'm hoping to kind of delve deeper into that. If I may pull out some of those threads that you've laid out for us. Let's look at the financing issue that you laid out, health financing. I'm with you when you say that there is a shared responsibility, but let's look at the budget allocation for the public healthcare sector under the federal government. There's been decades of underinvestment in public healthcare, and I think we are slightly just over 2% of GDP in terms of total public health spending. There's been calls to increase that budget allocation to between 5 to 6% of GDP over the next few years. I understand that the financing component for shared responsibility is one part, but there is this underinvestment that we need to first address. Very unpopular given the current state of federal coffers. How do you see that part, the budget allocation part? Do you see appetite for increasing that from federal government? whoever wins federal government.
Melissa, yes, I do see that there is an increased incentive for political parties to put their money where their mouth is and provide more funding for healthcare. Why? Because we've seen in the COVID, say 2 years or so that we've had COVID, 3 years now, sorry, I apologize, health is now high politics. Now, what is high politics and low politics? Traditionally, high politics are things like employment, job security, economic growth development, national security. These things are considered high politics. And all the time, people talk about this during elections in Malaysia with one addition of anti-corruption and good governance initiatives. So those are considered high politics. Health, education, social welfare, welfare assistance to the indigent, to the poor, the B40s, the older populations of Malaysia. These things are generally not a high priority. But the last 3 years have changed all that, and now health can be considered high politics. So there's definitely a lot of interest by governments to fund healthcare, not just in Malaysia, but in many other countries as well. I'll go on to make several more brief points, Melissa. The first one being to say that it's great that the Ministry of Health Malaysia has a larger budget for 2023 compared to 2022. This assumes that the next government will pass the budget and confirm the allocation, and that's great. But that's also coming on along on the sidelines of a reduction in overall income tax and overall corporate taxes as well. So we can't, the government rather, cannot continue spending money and cutting taxes at the same time. I'm not saying we should increase taxes. I'm saying we should be very careful about the sources and the users of that funds. And we shouldn't spend unnecessarily because our children will then bear the brunt of paying the debt, the next generations and so on, for example. Now, the second comment that I'll make over here is that while we welcome the allocations to the Ministry of Health, allocations to other ministries are also important. Why? Because in COVID, we see that Ministry of Health did a lot of work at the hospitals. But when we're looking at a disease like COVID or something that we call the social determinants of health, which in other words, the conditions in which you live, work, grow old, the conditions in which you stay and spend your time and the people that you spend your time with and so on. So allocations needs to be increased as well to the Ministries of Education, Women and Community Development, because they're in charge of the B40 and also the disabled populations of Malaysia, and various other ministries as well, so that they can have something that we call health in all policies. Thirdly and finally, the promise made by Minister for Health, Khairi Jamaluddin, just before the election announcement, was that he wanted to increase the spending on healthcare from 2.5% of GDP in Malaysia's public healthcare system to 5% of GDP in Malaysia's public healthcare system only. This is welcome, and we look forward to this coming to fruition, perhaps with a few guiding principles. The first one being, it should be gradual over a period of maybe 5, 10, 15 years or so, and not doubling it over a period of a year, because the absorptive capacity for Ministry of Health would need to grow in tandem over time. So that's one important guiding principle, gradualism. The second important guiding principle is, if we're pegging to 5% of GDP, what if our GDP shrinks or Malaysia enters a recession or Malaysia's economy becomes smaller, then the number will become correspondingly lower if we peg it to GDP. One idea is not only to peg it to GDP, but to peg it to a progressively increasing formula based on last year's budget. This allows the Ministry of Health to forward project and to plan for the coming few years as well. So there are advantages and disadvantages, which we'll always have to manage around pegging something to GDP. Melissa, these are the perhaps considerations, both political and fiscal, for the government, this one, and also the next one, as they come into power. Over to you.
Definitely. So health in all policies. I think we often forget that health is not just under the health ministry. It is under all ministries. Swee King, when you talked about the shared responsibility in terms of healthcare financing, were you referring to some form of social health insurance, something along the lines of what we currently practice with EPF and SOCSO? Was that the framework that you were referring to when you proposed a shared responsibility for healthcare?
Melissa, this is one of my let's call it the social health insurance model, or another term for it is the contributory scheme. And the umbrella term is contributory scheme, under which there are many different terminologies that different countries have applied. They've called it national health insurance, social health insurance, voluntary health insurance, and various other names in different countries whenever they've incepted. So the idea is a contributory scheme as a guiding principle. And yes, I was referring to a contributory scheme. I'll continue by saying that when we look at European countries or even South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and these are high-income Northeast Asian nations, when we look at this group of countries in North, well, we got to accept the United States because of a very unique, quite dysfunctional healthcare system. So let's not talk about that, maybe another show. But let's look at Europe and the high-income countries of Northeast Asia. All of them, without exception, has a contributory scheme in place. Why is this contributory scheme in place? For two reasons. One, it was a historical legacy. For example, in Germany, all the way up to Chancellor Bismarck in the 1800s, introduced a concept of a health insurance that's linked to employment. So there's a factor of a historical legacy. But secondly, it's also a factor of realization on the government side, right? That tax-funded healthcare systems are helpful to an extent to provide the base, but anything above that will probably need to be supplemented or to be contributed to by something that they call a contributory scheme. So this is one feature of high-income countries around the world. Secondly, it's also not only a feature of high-income countries, it's also a feature of middle-income countries. In Southeast Asia alone, Thailand introduced a contributory scheme in 1999. Like, that's a long time ago. The Philippines Health Insurance Corporation, or PhilHealth, was also incorporated in 1999. These days, Thailand has got three schemes. The Philippines has got the PhilHealth scheme that covers essentially, well, on paper, they cover 100%. In reality, they cover 90-something percent of the population. Indonesia started a little later, 2014, and that was already 8 years ago, through something called Jaminan Kesehatan Nasional, with their beautiful Indonesian spelling, or J-A-M-E-N-A-N, Jaminan Kesehatan Nasional. And even in middle-income countries, Malaysia's peer benchmarks, there are already good examples of Thailand, Philippines, and Indonesia of it already currently working, not only in those of high-income countries. Over to you, Melissa.
Well, wouldn't that mean, so I guess I'm wondering for, would that only cover a specific segment of the population? Because, you know, you're probably... pulling from a group of the taxed or the working population, there will be a significant portion that will not be included on this, similar to the way our tax base is actually quite small compared to many other countries. Are there issues that, you know, around social health financing, social health insurance, excuse me, that still needs to be kind of worked or thought through?
Melissa, the a very legitimate concern about social health insurance would be the fact that it is not easy to cover those in the informal sector. If you're in the formal sector, for example, you draw a salary on a monthly basis, you can go to the employers. And here are some numbers, right? In Malaysia, there are 15 million people in the economy in terms of the labor force, about 15, 16 million people in the labor force. We have 1 million companies ranging from one employee all the way to the Petronas of the world with 50,000 employees. So it's much easier to go to 1 million employers than it is to go to 15 million people to collect the funds from them. And therefore, if you go to the employers, you will then find it difficult to reach out to those who don't have employment or are in the gig economy or are in the informal sector. And that is a legitimate concern for any social health insurance programs around the world. That is often a matter of execution then and of implementation. Now, social health insurance, for example, if we're going to implement, will take years, 5, 10, 15 years or so. It's a politically very difficult and very sensitive discussion and decision to make. And that gradual process of 5 to 15 to 20 years of implementation will begin, should begin or can begin with individual populations. Let me invent some examples. The largest employer in Malaysia is the Malaysian government. There's 1.6 million people already. Gradually put them into phases, then you've got a pool of 1.6 million people, and that's pretty big. Then you go on to the multinational companies, perhaps. Then you go on to the plantation and construction and agricultural workers. And then you just go from one sector to another. Leaving behind, say, a group of people who are in the informal economy and not linked to employment, then you have to aggressively go out to get them into the social health insurance scheme, assuming it's a social health insurance scheme, because there are multiple types of schemes under the contributory scheme. And frankly, there are many, many benefits, not just in health, of bringing people from the informal sector to the formal sector. You get recognition, you get legal protection, customers get protection, your income tax base increases as well. There are many benefits of getting people from the informal sector to the formal sector, and health is only one of those benefits. Over to you, Melissa.
Right. Okay. So we're going to take a quick break here on Consider This, but let's come back and continue. Still a lot of ground to cover about making health a key election issue in GE15. We'll be right back here on Consider This. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation with Dr. Koh Swee King. He's the co-founder of the Malaysian Health Coalition. We're discussing the need to make healthcare a key election issue in GE15. You know, some of the things you mentioned, Swee King, are long-term plans and reforms that are desperately needed but may be a difficult pill to swallow at first. How do we ensure that whichever party coalition or forms government in Putrajaya fulfills this or carries this through to make sure that reforms are not vulnerable to the vagaries of Malaysian political instability or the lack of strength of any one party that forms government?
Melissa, thank you for this very important question. Let's begin with some statistics. In the last 3 years of COVID, since 2020, Malaysia's had 3 prime ministers and 3 health ministers, 1 director general of health, who's been there to stay the ship and just been there to guide the Ministry of Health, and that's been very helpful. But the 3 prime ministers and 3 health ministers in the last 3 years alone is symptomatic of the chronic instability that we project will happen in the next 5 to 10 years or so. In this instability, there are 3 things that we can do. Number one, we need to create an institution called the Health Reform Commission that has been mooted by Minister Khairi Jamaluddin as well before the election announcement, to create a Health Reform Commission. And we can debate endlessly about how many people, who should be the skills, what skills they should have, who should they be accountable to, what are the terms of reference. We can discuss all that. The creation of a Health Reform Commission is intended to be a body that provides strategic advice and supervises the implementation of these health reforms. And they will support the Ministry of Health, work with the Ministry of Health and not above it in order to get these reforms to be in place. There should be some transfer of political power and financial power to the Health Reform Commission, making it accountable all the time, obviously, because that kind of legitimacy politically and financially cannot just be given to an institution without good governance. So there should be a Health Reform Commission. Prime ministers and health ministers come and go, but the Health Commission stays for 10 to 15 years. At the end of 10 to 15 years, I have a second plan. And that second plan is to call it a Health Service Commission. The same way we've got Suhakam, which is a Human Rights Commission, the Securities Commission, the Energy Commission, the Multimedia and Communications Commission, and X number of commissions, there should perhaps also be a Health Service Commission that is in charge of setting policies and providing the overall strategic direction for the organization, also responsible perhaps eventually for hiring and firing too. That's the Health Reform Commission. Perhaps after that, the Health Service Commission. The second thing, Lisa, is to look a little bit at, the second thing is to create something that we can call a report card for health. Now, this report card for health should be an annual report. And who should write the report? It could be a combination of civil societies, think tanks, NGOs, research institutes, and universities to come up with an annual or every 2 years, a report card for health. We already have certain report cards in Malaysia. For example, there is a CSO platform for reform in Malaysia. There's an all-party parliamentary group as a second possible secretariat. And a third element is that Malaysia has got a universal periodic review of our commitments to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And these are good models for us to create a report card for the health performance of the ministers and the government that comes in. And that report card should not only be for Ministry of Health, it should be for other ministries of health, other ministries as well, I apologize. So therefore, 2 things, right? The first one, Health Reform Commission. Secondly, a report card for health. Thirdly, is to consider longer term changes within the public administration of the Ministry of Health. And this is where the health reform white paper, which is anchored by a secretariat within the Ministry of Health, as well as Minister Khairi Jamaluddin, has done some thinking about what is the correct role of the Ministry of Health. At the moment, the Ministry of Health is performing multiple roles at the same time. They deliver the service, so they're a service provider. Number two, they pay for the services from the private sector. Number three, they regulate, or they also set standards. Number four, indirectly, they own assets. So to be four roles at the same time is quite complicated for any organization. So a careful thinking process about the correct role of Ministry of Health so that it's appropriately sized, doing the appropriate things at the appropriate times, will make it easier for us to guide these reforms in the long term. The point is, we enhance the organizational chart of the public administration of the Ministry of Health to such an extent that civil service becomes a very powerful ally to the ministers to achieve the public objective. These are the three ways in which we can survive any political transition. Health Reform Commission, report card for health, and thirdly, a proper and careful restructuring of Ministry of Health organization. Over to you, Melissa.
Okay. On that last note of the role of the Ministry of Health, how does that tie in to one of the key areas that you pointed out in the very beginning of human capital, of human resource development and management of healthcare professionals? Should that remain under the Ministry of Health? And I do wonder, because again, you pointed to the kind of hemorrhaging of talent, you know, leaving the public sector to the private, leaving the country even to other to other greener pastures, if I may. How do we think about human capital, retaining our human capital, healthcare professionals?
Melissa, this is an exceedingly difficult question to answer. I'll complicate the question even more and then attempt to answer it. To complicate the question even more in terms of human capital, right, is to talk about how there are multiple players, all with their different, agendas. There's the Ministry of Health, who hires the doctors, Ministry of Education, licenses out how many medical schools, together with the Malaysian Qualifications Agency, how many medical schools, and controls a bit of the intake and minimum quality. Thirdly, there's a Malaysian Medical Council just for doctors and different councils for different healthcare professions as well. And then fourthly, we've got Jabatan Perkhidmatan Awam, which is actually the hiring branch, or the HR branch of the Malaysian government. So the Ministry of Health can only hire X number of health professionals, and X depends on JPA, not really depends on MOH. Of course, there's a good collaboration and good partnership. They talk very well to each other, but one proposes, the other disposes. And that's to complicate the situation with the multiple different actors with different job descriptions. Melissa, secondly, is to say that health professionals leave government to the private and leave Malaysia to other countries for different reasons. And let me give you a list. Different people have different intensities and rank orders in this list. Money is one reason, better pay in private sector, better pay in other countries. Number two, a second reason is actually bigger than money, is job satisfaction. If I'm able to do the work that I love in a situation that is less administrative, not so bureaucratic, there's no red tape, there's very little red tape, there's very little paperwork, I get to do the clinical work instead of filling up forms. And that's another incentive to leave. A third incentive to leave would be, I'm looking for career opportunities, advancements, to get scholarships and master's programs to do the field that I want to, instead of getting posted to a particular discipline or department that I don't want to. So these are three reasons. Yes, there's obviously financial considerations, but job satisfaction, the administrative burden of being in an organization, and thirdly, career satisfaction are also important feelings as well. Now, if it's not just money, then we can also improve other things, like make sure there's no culture of bullying. This is one reason why people leave, not money. I want dignity in my life. I don't want to be scolded unnecessarily or inappropriately. Hold me accountable, just don't be a jerk about it. So I think we have to be mindful about anti-bullying, creating a safe workplace culture that is service-oriented, pleasant and conducive to working. And that requires some softer skills, organizational leadership and HR skills that are needed, not just pure brute force clinical skills. And on and on and on will go down the list. And I'll just give you one example of how anti-bullying measures can also help increase retention in Malaysia's civil service. Over to you, Melissa.
Well, unfortunately speaking, we've run out of time, and I'm sure that we will continue to have this conversation. It's not just a one-off conversation. It's a conversation that must continue and also include all stakeholders so that political parties continue to feel the pressure from the public. So thank you so much for joining me on the show today. That was my conversation with Dr. Koh Swee King from the Malaysian Health Coalition. That wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.